Hi, folks. Bob Main here with another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. Episode 315, to be exact, going to talk about the unthinkable in this episode. You'll see why it's called that, or you'll hear it in a few moments. But took a week off last week. This is almost a weekly show. Every once in a while I have to, due to circumstances, personal circumstances or whatever, take a week off. But I'm never away from the podcasting world too long. So I've got another interview this week. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Dr. John Adine has been on several other podcasts talking about doctors for responsible gun ownership. But in this episode, it's a little different than what you've heard on some of the other podcasts. We go into some other subjects that Dr. Adine is also very knowledgeable about. So I didn't want to just make this a review of what he said on other shows. I did ask him to talk about some other topics. For example, gun-free zones and concealed carry. And we also discussed how an active shooter or active killer, how he goes about thinking and planning and preparing what he does. Pretty chilling stuff, actually. So I think you're going to really enjoy it. So here we go. Let's get Dr. John Adine from San Antonio. There'll be a quick break, and then we'll go right to the interview.
When did you first know about the program, officially, I believe, called Fast and Furious? To the best of your knowledge, what date?
I'm not sure of the exact date, but I probably heard about Fast and Furious for the first time over the last few weeks.
How about the head of the criminal division, sure, Lanny Brewer? Did he authorize it?
I'm not sure whether Mr. Brewer authorized it. I mean, you have to understand the way in which the department operates. Although there are operations, this one has gotten a great deal of publicity.
Yeah, there are dead Americans as a result of this failed and reckless program. So I would say that it hasn't gotten enough attention, has it, Mr. Attorney General?
It's not necessarily. I mean, there's an investigation that is underway, and we'll have to look at that to see exactly what happened with regard to...
Well, Mr. Attorney General...
I mean, I take very seriously the allegations...
Mr. Attorney General, do you take seriously... Mr. Attorney General, do you take seriously a subpoena signed by the Clerk of the House?
Of course.
Well, Mr. Attorney General, isn't it true that those cases that will go to trial in June, I have very limited time, I'm sorry, those cases are basically a bunch of meth addicts who did the buying, that you do not have what this program was supposed to produce. You don't have the kingpins. You don't have the places it went. What you have are the people that you already had on videotape many, many months before indictments were brought. Isn't this true?
There are cases that are important that we are trying to bring, that we want to try successfully, and they are part of a scheme. They are part of a scheme. You can't look at a case and it's an individual matter and think it is unimportant, because small cases lead to larger ones.
We're looking at you, straw purchasers. We're looking at you. We're looking at your key people who knew or should have known about this, and whether or not your judgment was consistent with good practices, and whether or not instead the Justice Department is basically guilty of allowing weapons to kill Americans and Mexicans. So will you agree to cooperate that investigation both on the House and Senate side?
We'll certainly cooperate with all the investigations, but I'm going to take great exception to what you just said. The notion that somehow or other this Justice Department is responsible for those deaths that you mentioned, that assertion is offensive. And I want to tell you that...
But what if it's accurate, Mr. Attorney General?
It is the policy of the Justice Department to make sure that we do all that we can to protect law enforcement agents. It is one of the reasons why I have tried to look at, you know, a whole variety of methods, techniques that we can use to protect the lives of law enforcement agents. It is something that this country is not focused enough on.
What am I going to tell Agent Terry's mother about how he died at the hand of a gun that was videotaped as it was sold to a straw purchaser, fully expecting it to end up in the hands of drug cartels?
Well, you know, one will have to see exactly what happened with regard to the guns that are at issue there. And I've attended funerals, you know. This is something that, this isn't theoretical, this is not political, this is extremely real for me as Attorney General.
It is for us, too.
Okay, well, my guest in this episode is Dr. John Adine right here in San Antonio. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's good. I'm glad you're here. Now, I want to tell everybody who's listening to this, Dr. Dean's taken a couple of classes with Ben and myself. I think you've been to, I know for sure, two of them, right?
I've been to all of them.
All of them? Oh, well, gosh, I tell you what. Maybe my recent cancer treatments have eroded my memory or something. I don't know.
Well, but, you know, you haven't been there for a lot of them, but I did the rifle course with Ben. Of course, we did the close-range gunfighting 2 course. I did the nighttime course, which is the one that where I met you guys, actually. That was the first one I did. I've done Beyond Concealed Carry. I did the one up in Dallas, which is a little bit more advanced one. I can't even remember the name of it. But,
yeah, that was...
I did the rifle course with Ben, too, so...
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You did my Suarez International Close Range Gunfighting 2 that I was teaching that Ben was helping out as a safety officer. I remember that one, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. And by the way, thanks for the shout-out on Gun Talk. I appreciate that.
Oh, you guys are welcome.
Well, all right, let me let everybody know, you are a physician. You are a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. Did I get that right?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. And you practice here in San Antonio? And you're very active with Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. Tell us just a little bit about that organization.
Yeah, Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership was founded by Dr. Timothy Wheeler. It was initially a Claremont Institute project, and recently the Second Amendment Foundation has brought it under its umbrella. Tim Wheeler is still kind of the engine that runs that organization. But he's recently retired, so there's several of us who have now stepped in to help, and we're trying to instill some new blood in the organization. We take on the American Academy of Pediatrics, the AMA, the CDC when it comes out with some of the baloney research and the... Not the CDC, it's
the AMA.
Well, you know, no, it's the national, the guys who do research. I can't think of the name. Hang on. NIH.
Oh, the National Institute of Health.
Right.
Yes.
When they come up with this bogus research, we point out the fault in their reasoning, and we publish articles to rebut a lot of stuff that comes out.
Yeah. Well, now, Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership can be found at drgo.us. And I think it's really awesome that the Second Amendment Foundation has made that one of their projects, because I'm a huge advocate of the Second Amendment Foundation. I mean, they're winning so many victories for gun rights. I encourage everybody, if you have not become a member or at least even made a small financial contribution to the SAF, or drgo.us, do that now.
Yeah, thank you. We're looking for more and more people to try to be contributors in whatever way. You know, we would like to have some people that can write. Also, just people who are politically active like I am on a local level. We're trying to expand our numbers, and we're still kind of working out the details, but I think fairly soon we're going to have our website pretty much up and running and the membership aspect of it smoothed out so we can really get the numbers going.
Good. Now, I want to talk about gun-free zones in several minutes, because that's a passion of yours and it's a passion of mine, the elimination of gun-free zones. But before getting into that, I want to tell people the name of your article is The Unthinkable, An Active Shooter in a Hospital. Now, I think this is awesome, because I think a hospital is a place that... You know, almost all of them are gun-free zones, and people don't even give it a second thought. They forget about the fact that things can happen in hospitals. Why don't you talk about that July 2014 shooting in the hospital that's in your article that you write about?
Well, we're talking about the shooting that happened in Darby, Pennsylvania. There was a man who was a convicted felon who had been already arrested for a felon in possession, who had an appointment with Dr. Lee Silverman. His social worker, caseworker, Teresa Hunt, brought him to see Dr. Silverman at that point, the shooter shot her in the face and killed her, and then took a shot at Dr. Silverman. Fortunately, Dr. Silverman ignored the gun-free zone sign and the policy of his hospital and was actually carrying his weapon. He was able to access his weapon and stop the shooter, and they were able to disarm the guy. And his plan was to kill a lot of people. He still had, I think, 30-something rounds in his pocket still that he was going to use to go around and kill people with.
Yeah, your article says he had 39 rounds of ammunition. Now, this happened in a hospital, right?
Right. It was part of the outpatient part of a community hospital.
Now, people don't even think about this because, you know, there are all different sections of a hospital. There's all different departments. This happened in the outpatient department. But, you know, in inner cities, I've heard you talk about it when you were on other podcasts. You were recently on Gun Talk with Tom Gresham. You were recently on the Polite Society podcast with Paul Lathrop. And a lot of people don't realize that, you know, especially in a lot of inner city ERs, sometimes you get some pretty unsavory characters in those ERs, don't you?
Absolutely. There's a lot of, for instance, gang shootings. When they bring a guy in with a gunshot wound, a lot of times the other gang members will follow him to the ER and they'll continue the battle right there in the ER. And unfortunately, even in ERs where they have police officers, those guys are often outgunned when you have 10 guys show up with guns and start shooting. There's not much they can do.
So I want you, the listener, to think about what Dr. Dean here is saying. You go to the ER because there's something that's wrong with you that's an emergency, and you're sitting there either in the waiting room in an ER or you're in a bed in an ER, and a gangbanger is brought in, and they're going to get brought in because they, you know, I mean, if they're suffering a life-threatening illness or life-threatening injury, they have to be brought into the ER. And as gang buddies show up and continue the fight, you're defenseless because now you're sitting in a gun-free zone and you're kind of defenseless, aren't you?
Absolutely. And there was a shooting up in Boston in January where there was a disgruntled patient who blamed the physician for his mother's death. He went to the ER, asked for the doctor. They directed him to where he was at, and then he took a .40 caliber pistol and shot him twice in the chest. And that doctor succumbed from his injuries. He had not a chance. And again, it's another gun-free zone. There's no defense against that.
Yeah. Now, something I want to point out in your article here, when you talk about that case in Darby, Pennsylvania, you said the killer, a convicted felon, he had already served prison time as a felon for possession of a gun. But here's the big enchilada right here. He walked right by the hospital's no guns allowed sign to execute his plan. Now, John, I'm surprised here. I'm shocked. Do you mean a criminal walked right past that no guns allowed sign? You mean they don't obey those?
You know, you would think it would be a magic talisman, that sign that would protect everybody, but it doesn't. Because criminals don't obey the law, only the gun, or the law-abiding gun owners do. The people with concealed handgun licenses who have something to lose if they violate the law. These guys don't have anything to lose. They don't care.
Wow, so the next time I go to the hospital, hopefully there isn't one, but if I do, or I go to the ER, I'm a sitting duck in there, and I don't know who's going to be in there, and whose friends or relatives are going to show up and cause some problems inside the hospital.
That's a possibility. Fortunately, we have not seen a lot of it yet. However, you know, sooner or later, I think things are going to be, things can get, you know, worse and worse over time. If we don't get rid of these gun-free zones, sooner or later, people are going to figure it out.
And we're going to get to that in a minute, but there's one more thing I want you to talk about. The way you start this article, I really like. And by the way, folks, I'm going to link to the article so you can read it for yourself. You talk about five phases that an active killer goes through. And I like this. I think you cite veteran police trainer Dan, I think he pronounces it Marcoux.
I think so. I don't know.
Yeah. But the first phase that most of these killers go through is the first one's fantasy. Talk about that.
Well, basically, what they do is they think up the idea. I want to go, get the high score. Where can I go to do that? They fantasize about it. And then the second step, of course, is planning it out. And a lot of times they'll write it down, maybe even discuss it with other people. And then the third phase is preparation, where they actually acquire the tools that they're going to need, whatever weapons, bombs, ammunition. During that time, they may also warn some of their friends not to go to school that day. And then the fourth one is the approach, and that's when they're actually moving to the place of the shooting. And then, of course, the final one is implementation, and that's when the killing starts.
Yeah, I see, and I'm glad you pointed that out in your article, and I'm glad you talked about it here. I wanted you to talk about it here on my show because a lot of people don't think about that, and a lot of them ignore those warning signs. I think ignoring some of these warning signs up front, that's one way that a lot of these killers actually get away with it, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when all these things happen afterwards, people always say, yeah, there was something weird with that guy. He was kind of a strange bird, and he was always, you know, talking this or saying that, and we just didn't take him seriously. But now when they look, you know, in retrospect, they realize, you know, this was the problem from the get-go, and this is the guy that was showing the warning signs.
Yeah, I'm just having a difficult time with something here, and what I'm having a difficult time with is, you know, you're saying that these criminals just walk right by these no guns allowed signs and they don't obey them. I mean, that's just, you know, that's shocking to me. Of course, I think most people can pick up on my sarcasm there. So let's go ahead and talk about gun-free zones. I dislike them with a passion, just like you. You said it's kind of one of your pet projects.
Right. When I first started to, when I first decided to do something about being a gun activist, and I talked with Dr. Tim Wheeler at the Gun Rights Policy Conference in 2013. I kind of sat down and thought, what can I do? What's the problem that I can really put my finger on? And the one that really bothers me was every time I had to go in the hospital, I have to disarm. And I realized that in a very large hospital, if there were ever a shooting, first of all, by the time the police get there, things would probably be over, but then the police actually have to find the part of the hospital where the shooting's at, and that can take them another 5 or 10 minutes. You know, the time is of the essence when you get into these active shooter situations. Seconds count, and these guys can shoot and kill or wound somebody every few seconds. Well, every minute that you're waiting could be 5 or 10 people, and in a heavy populated building like a hospital, there's plenty of targets.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people aren't mobile. A lot of people are in bed. They're on ventilators. And then we have to deal with the issue of the hospital staff. I can tell you right now that many of my colleagues are not going to abandon their patients when somebody starts shooting. They're going to try to lock the place down, and you know, hopefully they're not going to become a victim, but a lot of them will not leave. You're going to have family members that aren't going to leave either. And so this is a victim-rich environment for these active shooters. And, we just can't leave them in place.
Well, no, we can't. And I think there's talk in the Texas legislature right now about reducing the amount of gun-free zones, isn't there?
Yeah, there's actually several bills that are up right now. There are two in the House and one in the Senate. The two in the House, there's House Bill 308 and House Bill 695. 308 is already in front of the committee. 695 is not in front of the committee. And then the Senate bill is 311, and that's sponsored by Dr. Donna Campbell, who is a state senator here in Texas and who is actually my state senator as well.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah. And so these bills are designed to get rid of some of the gun-free zones. The 695 bill is actually kind of interesting because it actually has some teeth to it in that it forces hospitals, private hospitals who continue to keep the gun-free zone signs up because they have that option, that they're going to have to put an armed security guard at every entrance to the hospital.
Well, that's good because if they're not going to let us provide for our safety, then the least they could do is put guards out there to help a little bit.
Absolutely right. But even that's probably not enough, too. Really, what they should be doing is locking the place down with metal detectors and then armed security. That I think is reasonably adequate. Anything less than that, we're still sitting ducks. Anybody can walk right by a security guard with a concealed weapon, and they're not going to, you know, the security guard's not going to know. And I can tell you that a lot of the hospitals that I work at, they have multiple entrances. Some of them have 5, 6, 7, 8 entrances, which means that the hospitals are going to have to hire armed security guards, which is at a higher level than the security guards they have now, because our security guards only carry tasers for the most part. They don't carry firearms.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the thing is, you see, we got unarmed security guards, and they're not paying attention. And you're right, somebody with a concealed gun, a bad guy with a concealed gun, that no doubt doesn't have a license to carry it, can walk right by these security guards, and they can wreak all kinds of havoc. Now, you know, Texas, among other states, is also eliminating a gun-free zone. Most likely, hasn't passed yet, but we're going to most likely pass campus carry here.
Well, I think that's a good thing. You know, they're trying to propagandize, saying that, you know, you have, you know, kids that are just out of high school getting drunk and, you know, going crazy right after getting out of school, you know, carrying guns. Well, that's not the case at all, because you have to be 21 years old in order to carry. What about all the veterans that have come back from the Middle East who are now pursuing education after getting out of the military? All these guys are qualified to handle firearms. They've already been under fire. And these are the ideal guys that you want on campus. They're the good guys, and they're experienced good guys. Also, if you're a truck driver, or if you're a delivery man or whatever, all those guys have to be disarmed when they have to go into a college. So these are all people that, you know, that could actually be on the spot if there's, you know, if there's an active shooter situation, or just, you know, a rape on campus is a whole other big issue. You know, there's it's an epidemic, and women are disarmed and they can't protect themselves when you're in a gun-free zone. You know, there's do you remember the name of the woman that was raped in Nevada?
No, I know. I think I know what you're talking about, but I don't remember the name.
Yeah, actually, let me see if I can find her name.
Yeah, and while you're searching for that, I want the listeners to know that, you know, I'm passionate about getting rid of gun-free zones too. You know, I think gun-free zones are just absolutely ridiculous. You know, one of the problems is that not only are we sitting ducks, but it's just a huge advertisement for bad guys to come in there and, you know, do their dirty deeds inside that building.
Yeah. So her name was Amanda Collins, and she was raped within 100 feet of the police office at the in the parking structure at the university in Reno. Of course, the police had all gone home for the night, so there was nobody there. She was by herself, and had she been armed, she says that she could have stopped the rape at some point in time during the attack.
And don't you think her attackers knew that the police were gone?
Oh, absolutely, he knew. And that guy went on to kill another person. And so, you know, had she been able to stop him, this other girl would still be alive right now. And she testified in Colorado during those hearings, and they made fun of her.
Hey, I like ducks. I like that ringtone.
Yeah, thank you. My wife says I'm a quack. That's why I have that.
You're a Dr. Quack. I like that.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, they basically blew her off. You know, says, oh, you couldn't have helped yourself, even if you were armed, which is not the case. You know, so gun-free zones in universities don't help anybody. In fact, they make for good victims, especially among women. And fortunately, women are becoming more and more aware of that fact, and they're the biggest growing segment of our firearms owner and new student population.
Yeah, they're also the fastest growing segment of CHL applicants and CHL holders. I know for a fact in almost every state, the record number of women are applying and getting their license if their state requires one.
Right, and of course, you know, you and Ben did the courses for me that I brought physicians and nurses to. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is to get people trained and introduce new shooters, especially women, especially nurses in my situation, so that they don't become a victim. I want them to be able to defend themselves and to pursue concealed handgun licenses if they are comfortable with that option.
So what do you think is the most effective way, or one of the most effective way, to get rid of gun-free zones? And before you answer that, I want to talk about something. You know, recently here, House Bill 308 has been very actively opposed by that. What's that organization of a bunch of moms? Is it Moms Against Gun Violence or something like that?
Moms Demand Action, those guys?
Moms Demand Action, that's right. And one of them said a real brilliant statement. You know, she said that the legislature should be working to support more background checks. And this is what she said, quote, because background checks is the only proven way to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people, unquote. Now, my question is, how many of these dangerous people go get a background check, and where is the proof? She says it's the only proven way. Where is that proof?
That's in her own mind, because there's no documented studies that show that. We all know that the criminal element does not go through a background check. First of all, they wouldn't pass a background check, the majority of them. Another segment of them will get people who don't have a conviction to straw purchase for them.
Exactly.
And so they're not going through the background check. They're getting a straw purchaser to go through the background check. And then, of course, there's just the plain old stolen guns and, you know, the black market, so to speak, in firearms. These guys don't go to a gun dealer. They don't go to an FFL to get their licenses, you know, to get their background checks. They just, you know, they'll buy it from their gang buddy, or they'll steal it.
Yeah. Isn't that a brilliant statement? It's the only proven way to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people. Oh, yeah. You know, if that was really true, if that really worked, then every state would have passed background checks, and we could all be reporting about the huge reduction of crimes committed by bad guys with a gun. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, I mean, the only, you know, in the states where they have passed this, what they're really doing is they're making honest citizens into criminals, because I'm sure that not everybody is going through these background checks. I'm sure in Colorado they're not going through the background checks. I know that probably in Washington State they're not going through all the background checks. They're certainly passing guns back and forth in Washington State in defiance of the law.
Absolutely. So, John, what do you think is one of the best things we can all do collectively to help get rid of gun-free zones?
Well, I mean, the first thing is, you know, we have to talk about it. So we have to have discussions with people who may not even think about it as an issue. In my case, I spend a lot of time in the doctor's lounge talking about a lot of these issues. And
what do they say to you?
Yeah, and I spent actually this past summer, I walked around the hospital and actually had a petition that I put out to try to get rid of allow CHL holders who are hospital staff to be able to carry with the administration's permission. And I got almost 500 signatures before the hospital administration basically told me I had to stop because it violated their non-solicitation policy. But in talking with a lot of these people, almost 80% of the people I talked to were actually in favor of this. They get it. They realize that we're sitting ducks. And you know, I'm sure I stimulated a lot of conversation in my wake. So I'm sure a lot of people were talking with other people about it.
Right. You probably did. Yes.
And in fact, a lot of people came up to me and said, "Hey, you're that doctor that was talking about gun-free zones, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, that's me." So just having the conversation, sooner or later, you know, whether these laws pass or not, we're going to have to demand something from the administration of the hospital, even if it has to be, you know, you know, a town hall meeting where we have a big discussion and we, you know, speak out in support of or against it. But, you know, I find that the majority of the people who work in the hospital realize that they're a sitting duck and that they want protection, and that the protection that's offered by the hospital is inadequate.
Well, I agree with you that we have to talk about the issue. I agree with you in part. I think there's something else that we need to do. We need to get aggressive, and I don't mean in an offensive way. We don't need to get offensive. We need to get aggressive. There's a big difference between offensive and being aggressive. And when I say aggressive, like, we need to take these people who say stupid things like the only proven way to keep guns out of bad people's hands is to do a background check, and we need to ask them, cite your proof. That's being aggressive without being offensive.
Right. Well, Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership does a lot of that on the medical side of the house. But you're right. I mean, we still need to not let them get away with falsehoods and generalities without backing it up with fact. They rely on an emotional argument, and we rely on a factual argument. They play, you know, people's emotions and their fears, and, you know, that only goes so far. Unfortunately, facts only go so far too when you're dealing with people who deal in the world of emotion and fear. So there has to be some kind of middle ground that we're going to have to take where we use emotion plus facts in order to diffuse and debunk their arguments.
Well, John, do you sense something? Because I do. Tell me if you agree. I sense that the anti-gun people realize that slowly but surely they're losing. And the reason I say that is because look at Kansas. Kansas recently became the sixth state to approve constitutional carry. Look what's going on here in Texas. Look what recently the state of Utah did. Look at recently with Wisconsin and even Illinois now with concealed carry. I think the anti-gunners realize they are losing. And so what they're doing, what I sense, is they're getting more desperate, and that's the way that they're acting. What do you think about that?
Well, I can see that, yes, in kind of the free states, we're taking back some of our rights. The thing that concerns me, of course, is Bloomberg and all his money, where he's actually dumping so much money into either the legislature or in these public campaigns where he's actually buying elections and buying the legislature. That's a real issue. And, you know, it's hard to fight hundreds of millions of dollars that this guy can just, you know, take out of his pocket and throw down on the grassroots has a hard time matching that. So,
yeah.
Yes, in kind of the states between the coasts, I think we're taking back some of our rights. But if you look at the coasts, the Northeast and the West, you know, we're actually in a big struggle. You know, Oregon is right now in a big struggle. Of course, Washington last year, you know, really got stabbed in the back big time. And they're looking at going after Arizona and Nevada. So, you know, we have a fight on our hands. So in some places, yes, we're making progress, but other places, we're fighting for our lives.
Well, you're right. And let me clarify something. When I said they're losing, I don't mean that we should sit on our hands and go, oh, okay, but, you know, the fight's over. We won, and the anti-gunners are not going to get their way. That I was wrong. If I gave off that impression, I was wrong, because you're right. People like Bloomberg have lots of money. But I think that they're acting from an aggressive, desperate position. And also, when I say that they're losing, I'm talking about the fact that they had such a tight grip on us. They had so much gun control in this country. You know, we have to all think back to years and years and years ago. We didn't have, I mean, beginning with the Firearms Act of 1968 is when it really started eroding our rights big time. And I think we're starting to win back a lot of those. And that's what I meant when I said that they're losing, is they're seeing us start to win a lot of these rights back.
Right. And then, you know, recently there was a study that showed that among minority communities, gun ownership is going up too. Places like Detroit, you know, where gun ownership and concealed carry is actually on the rise, because the police, they can't protect the people there, and they realize they have to protect themselves. And even the chief of police there says, you know, you need to protect yourself. We can't guarantee that we can come help you. And so I think people are actually looking at the failures in government and seeing that, wait a second, the government is not going to be there to help me when I really need it. I need to be independent and take care of myself. And that kind of American entrepreneurial, you know, self-reliant spirit is what made this country great to begin with. And I think we need to continue to foster that self-reliance amongst all of our you know, ethnic groups and, you know, gun owners especially. We're independent. We want to be left alone. And, you know, but we need to keep fighting for our rights.
Well, you know, and you touched on something earlier when you were talking about the petition that you got 500 signatures at your hospital until you were asked to stop doing that. And you said those people who signed that petition, you said that they get it. And I think this is the discussion that we need to have. We need to have a frank, honest discussion with our peers because they're going to get it. I don't think a lot of people are going to buy into the desperation that the Bloombergs and the Moms Demand Action and all, when they start making these idiotic statements, I think that other people are going to get that these are a bunch of bozos, but they may not be paying attention right away. We have to actually have a discussion with them. And then I believe that they're going to start to get it, don't you?
I think so, too. I think the more we shine the light on the deceptions that the mainstream media is allowing to be perpetrated on the public, I think the more people are going to open their eyes and they're going to say, wait a second, this is not as it seems, and we need to start looking for ourselves to find the answers rather than to you know, rely on what the government and the mainstream tells us.
So, John, you're a doctor. I want to remind everybody. So you're in a hospital. Why is it that you think that hospitals post the property so heavily with the proper sign, 30-06 sign here in Texas?
Well, actually, there is a Texas government code that actually says that hospitals licensed under Chapter 241 shall prominently display at each entrance to the hospital a sign that complies with subsection C, and that is unlawful for a person licensed under this subchapter to carry a handgun on the premises. So there's actually a government code that requires hospitals to post.
Okay, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so that's part of it. And that's one of the things, that's one of the reasons why we need to get the law changed, because right now, as it stands, hospitals are supposed to post the signs.
They're required to.
Right. Right. And then the other thing is there's also something there that says that hospital administrators, however, can give written permission for people to, with concealed handgun licenses to carry. And that's what I was trying to take advantage of when I did the petition. But obviously the hospital is not going to be forthcoming. In fact, they're going to have to be drag kicking and screaming in order to allow us to do what needs to be done.
So the administrator can give written permission to who? Any of the medical staff?
Right. Anybody who has a concealed handgun license can carry conceal in a hospital if the hospital administrator provides permission. For instance, if they hire a security person who is an armed security person, they have to get permission from the hospital administration to carry their firearm. Police officers don't, but armed security guards do.
Yeah.
So they have to give written permission to carry.
So, John, you're a surgeon. If you were allowed tomorrow when you show up for work, assuming you're going to work tomorrow, but if you were allowed to carry, where in the hospital would you carry?
Everywhere.
Even in the OR?
Absolutely.
Really? Talk about that.
No, I use a belly band and put my shield on.
That's good. I like that.
Wear it under my scrubs. Leave my shirt draped. Ankle holsters are a little bit tough, but certainly a belly band. I have a crossbreed with the Ojai for the shield. Not a problem. I even can carry a spare magazine.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. Well, and of course, you know, you have to carry everywhere. I've said it how many thousands of times. If you're going to do it everywhere. Do it all the time, except, of course, I don't encourage anybody to break the law and carry in the legally posted no gun free zones. But I like your answer.
No, I mean, that's the problem. That's why I came to this to start with, because every time I come to the hospital and I'm wearing my normal clothes with my holster on. I got to put that, lock that gun up in a gun box in my car. And, that's extra handling of a firearm that it's just not necessary. And, every time you handle a firearm, as you and I both know, there's a risk of a negligent discharge or an accident, who knows. But why handle a firearm when you don't have to? Just leave it on. But the problem is the law forces you to take it off and on. And then, of course, if somebody's walking by while you're taking your gun off and they see you putting your gun away or seeing you putting your gun on, all of a sudden, especially if it's an anti-gun person, next thing you know, you're getting swatted. So,
yeah,
these are risks that we always take. But, the bottom line is I prefer not to take that risk and just to wear it all the time.
Something else, John, I'd like you to talk about. I've been noticing that doctors are becoming more and more pro-gun and interested in firearms. That's what it seems like to me. I always thought that most of them were anti-gun people, but do you notice that?
Yeah, in fact, Masad Ayoub says that physicians are probably the biggest single occupational group that takes his course. We had this discussion when I was taking the Mag 40 course last July. Surgeons for sure are more realistic, and I think they see the blood and guts, so to speak. So the surgical side of the world is more going to be more pro-gun than the medical side of the world, the more academic and cerebral guys who basically push pills for a living. I found that when I was walking around the hospital, when I got to the medical wards, a lot of the doctors, in fact, there was one doctor who says, yeah, I have a concealed handgun license, but I don't think anybody should be carrying in the hospital. It's okay for me to carry, but nobody else should be able to carry.
No kidding? That's what he said?
Yeah. So I should be able to carry, but I don't want anybody else carrying. So.
Did you ask him why?
Mumble.
Yeah.
Couldn't explain why, that was the way he felt.
Again, an emotional, irrational response.
Exactly. I mean, you can't fix that,
No.
But it's the typical, good enough for me, but not good enough for thee.
Hey, now let me say something. You're right. You can't fix that, but you can defeat that.
Oh, absolutely. You can fight it. You gotta go around it, though. You can't go over the top of it.
But you can defeat that. If we get aggressive enough, and I say aggressive, not offensive, if we get aggressive enough, we can defeat that with numbers and votes and popularities, and we can make people like that irrelevant.
Exactly. And I think that when you get into the hospital situation, I think, as I noted, when I was talking to the folks around the hospital, 80% of them were actually, amenable to what I was talking about. And only 20% of the people, and most of it was just plain fear, or I don't trust that guy to carry a gun, but the bottom line is it's not going to be everybody carrying a gun. It's only going to be a small percentage. But that provides herd immunity. So if the word is out that such and such hospital, a percentage of the staff are armed, I can tell you, if you're in the planning stage and you're a mass shooter, you're not going to be planning to do it at that hospital. You're going to go to some other hospital to do the damage. You're not going to go to the place where you know they're armed and that they're out there to protect their patients, their staff, and the families.
So why do you think physicians are so interested in firearms?
Because I think we see people at their best and at their worst. And we're realists. And Masad Ayoub actually put this in an article that he wrote in his blog back in, I think it was February, that we're realists. We see people at their worst. We see people trying to kill each other. We see people, traumatized. And we realize that, people can be really ugly and that people can have no qualms about harming other people. And so we're realist when it comes to that kind of stuff and that we need to, carry. In fact, I don't know if you heard the end of Tom Gresham's thing, but he was talking about the doctors that he knows that were carrying in the hospital. Of course, he's in Louisiana, different laws.
Yeah, exactly.
So listen, if I were in Louisiana, I'd be carrying too. But I'm in Texas, and I have to deal with the laws as they are now. And in Texas, it's a Class A misdemeanor. It's a jail time. It's a fine. And you lose your concealed handgun license for...
There you go, being a quack again.
Yeah, I know. That's my neighbor calling me. But you're going to lose your concealed handgun license for 5 years, and potentially I could lose my medical license. So... You have to weigh the risks and the benefits. I certainly don't want to be a criminal. I'm an honest, law-abiding person, and I don't want to be put in that position. Now, as a physician, it's my I have a moral duty to protect my patients, to ensure good outcomes, and this kind of stuff is very frustrating because I know that sooner or later something bad is going to happen, and it happens. It happens. We've already named two instances in just in the last 6 months. And there's a lot of violence that happens in hospitals. Hospital workers account for 10% of the violent victimology in the workplace.
Wow. John, let's go back to something we said earlier in the interview.
Sure.
That we talked about. This case in July of last year where Dr. Silverman actually saved people's lives because he was, in a sense, violating the hospital policy, and he was carrying, and he stopped a bad guy. Do you know, was Dr. Silverman punished at all by the hospital?
No, he wasn't punished by the hospital. In fact, the chief of police in the town said he was a hero. And so, no hospital in the world is going to punish somebody who the chief of police of the city is saying is a hero. That's such negative publicity that, hospitals aren't going to do that. We're really dealing with a case where the no gun sign does not carry weight of law in Pennsylvania. Texas, it does. And so
yes.
That's the difference.
Yeah, it does. It carries the weight of law here. And again, I'm going to say this again. I by no means encourage anybody to break the law. So I'm not encouraging anybody to carry in a legally posted no gun area if that is a huge, well, if it's any kind of a violation of your law. But I just thought it was interesting to point out that, he became a hero, as he should have been labeled a hero.
Absolutely. I think, and the thing is, I don't want to have to make that choice. I'd rather have it be being the law-abiding person that I am. I'm the good guy. I have a card that says I'm a certified good guy. It even says I'm a veteran on it. Okay? Why do I have to make that choice, whether to break the law or to be able to protect myself in my workplace? I think that that's a bad choice either way. It's a lose-lose for me.
Yeah, by the way, thank you for your service to this country. Where did you serve?
I served in the United States Navy. I did my orthopedic training at the U.S. Naval Hospital in Oakland, California. I spent 2 years as the medical officer aboard the USS Peleliu, which was an amphibious assault ship. And I spent 2 years as an orthopedic surgeon at the Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida.
Wow. Well, again, honorable. Thank you so much for your service, your honorable and distinguished service to this country. And I think a lot of people are going to latch on to your work with DRGO, and I hope that I'm helping a little bit. And I want to encourage people, read The Unthinkable, An Active Shooter in a Hospital. Read the article that Dr. Adin has written. I've read a good portion of it, and it's quite eye-opening.
Yeah, and I'm not the only one, actually. There's a doctor up in Bloomfield, Iowa, named Sean Broaddale, who's actually working on the same thing, trying to get his hospital to drop their gun-free zone stuff. And Sean and I talk on the phone. We text each other all the time. He's going through the same business that I am. The hospital administrators drag their feet. They do the passive-aggressive thing. And the only way we're going to get this stuff pushed through is by overwhelming numbers.
Yeah, and elections matter, folks. They matter. And if you care about not only this issue but others, you need to let your voice also be heard at the polls.
Yeah, and I'm planning on actually going up to Austin to testify in favor of some of these bills once they come in front of the committee.
Is that right?
Yeah. if I can swing it with my schedule. That's the issue, because they give you such short notice. You know, they give you a notice on Thursday that the thing's on Tuesday, and sometimes it's difficult to undo 50 patient appointments.
Yeah, or and especially if you got some surgery scheduled that day.
Right. So it can be difficult, but sometimes it can be done. But it's just, you know, it's important to me. So I'm going to try to do my best to get there, because I think that my voice carries a little bit more weight, especially when we're dealing with hospital issues. You know, people can, you know, people who don't live in hospitals and have to deal with this stuff, they can say all they want. But when you actually are in the middle of it, and you see the stuff that we see, you know, remember a few years ago, there was a doctor who was shot by an estranged patient who was in love with her, and he decided he was going to, you know, since she didn't pay any attention to him, she decided to kill her in her office parking lot. There was a doctor that I know that actually witnessed a shooting up in Fredericksburg outside the hospital. So it's not even necessarily in the hospital. We had a nurse that was robbed at gunpoint in the employee parking lot a couple of months ago at the hospital I worked at. So it's out there. It happens. It's not, you know, well, maybe this will happen and maybe it won't. This stuff happens. And so we need to really keep emphasizing, you know, the importance of getting rid of these gun-free zones. We all know that the signs don't work. They actually attract these psychopathic murderers. And now we've got the terrorist threat. I mean, I can go into the whole thing about the hospital takeover in Budenovsk in Russia, where they had 200 terrorists hit a hospital, took 2,000 hostages.
Wow.
You know, and you never heard about that one. They don't talk about that, but that happened, and these guys read the same playbook. So, you know, and you know, they attack hospitals in Israel with, you know, they have an attack in town. When they bring the wounded to the hospitals, they have a guy with a bomb vest who either follows the ambulance or is already pre-positioned. And then when all the EMS hits the ER, they light off their vests and kill a bunch of healthcare workers right in the emergency room and take out the emergency room itself. You know, these are the kind of things that we have to be aware of, and that we have to not get fooled by when this stuff starts happening.
And a lot of people don't even think about this, and I'm going to include myself as one of those. Time to wrap up. John, thanks a lot. This is Dr. John Adeen, and he's a pediatric orthopedic surgeon here in San Antonio. Finishing up, I'm going to give you, as a lot of people on TV like to say, I'm going to give you the last word. Talk about, you know, promo a couple things you got going on.
Well, you know, Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership is the organization that I'm in the leadership in. We're trying to increase our numbers. So if you're in the healthcare profession, you don't just have to be a doctor. You can be a nurse. You can be a technician. Anybody that works in the medical field, we would really like to have you look at our website and see what we're about. And if you want to become a member, to become active, we would really appreciate it.
And give out that website again.
It's drgo.us.
drgo.us. John, thanks a lot, and I'll see you at a class again soon.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Have a good one.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, many thanks to Dr. Adeen. Check out drgo.us, which is Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. Check out what he's doing there. Help out that organization if you can. Read his article. Go to the show notes and check out the link. I put a link to his article in that, and also to the Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. But I wanted to get into different topics, and I hope that you enjoyed that. I hope it was a little bit different than some of the other interviews that you heard on this subject. I want to close by talking about responsible gun ownership, and part of responsible gun ownership is making sure that you are well trained and know how to properly use your firearm. Don't forget that Ben and I have classes coming up in Northern Ohio. There's still some room for Sioux Falls, although that's getting pretty close to being sold out. That's the joint effort with Paul Lathrop from the Politics and Guns podcast. that we are teaching up there in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, next month, in the month of May. Hey, Glenn Tate's going to be joining us once again this summer in August in Squim, Washington, out near Seattle at Fort Discovery. There's still room in that class, although that tends to fill out early because, or fill up early because, hey, Glenn Tate and the team are big attractions. I need to get Glenn back on this show again pretty soon and talk about what's been going new. He's the author of the book series, 299 Days. And if you're still buying books, the 299 Days series, don't forget to go to my Amazon account, which I wanted to tell you about because you can help out my show and support my show without spending any extra money at all. How's that? Hey, we're all under budgets. I have budgets. We all live within our means. You don't have to spend any extra money. If you're going to make a purchase on Amazon, please do it through my account. Go to handgunworld.com. That's the main website. Click the Amazon store. Go to the Amazon link. Save that link. And every time you make a Amazon purchase, if you would just use my link, proceeds help the Handgun World podcast. Also, if you want to access excellent training videos, I think they're some of the best videos out there. We have a private site. Ben and I have a private site. That's Ben Branham from the Modern Self-Protection podcast. And it's a training site. It's a video training site. Doesn't take the place of live training. But that's one way that you can get some real good ideas on concealed carry, defensive shooting, even a little bit on holster use and all kinds of stuff like that. Go to join our Shooters Club for only $75 a year or only $8 a month. If it's easier to afford, you can take advantage of the $8 a month option. You can go to shootersclubmembers.com or you can go to handgunworld.com and click the Shooters Club page, and you can even watch a free sample video as well, and it's pretty cool stuff. Hey, don't forget about email updates. If you want to get an email from me every time I put up a new episode or update my web page with anything brand new, it'll shoot you a quick email and say, hey, this is available for you to look at or listen to. Go to handgunworld.com and you can get an email update. Just sign up there in the margin. And last but not least, voicemails. My voicemail number, 210-646-1727. That's 210-646-1727. Leave a voicemail 3 minutes or less, and I'll put you on the show. I'll make some comments. If it's a question, I'll answer it. If you don't want it to be aired on my show, just let me know when you call in. 210-646-1727. There's also a call me button at handgunworld.com to make it a little bit easier for you. Well, folks, thanks for listening to another episode of your weekly Handgun World podcast. I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Remember, the loudest sound a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Shoot straight, shoot safe. Talk to you next time. Goodbye.